Well, this is a treat. You know, I don't know, a couple months ago, we did one of our live stream video events, and we put the call out to the Garmy. Give us some ideas for people to interview on the show. Who would you like to have sit down opposite me on the microphone and get to know better? And you would be surprised. Well, you wouldn't be surprised because he's here today. But a lot of people said Brad Williams. And for that reason,
wow,
here he is. I mean, I always wanted to talk to him, but the demand insisted that we do it sooner than later.
I'm surprised yet not entirely shocked, because at my live shows to this day, people still come up to me and talk about when I had the honor of guest hosting Hollywood Babylon with you.
Yes, you're one of the few guest hosts we ever had.
Yeah, and how much fun that was, and it was. And so the fact that your fans reached out, that's fantastic.
Well, honestly, we share a lot of fans because of the K-Rock connection as well.
Absolutely.
Too. You were a big part of my time over there at Kevin and Bean, which we'll get into. We'll get into all of it.
Yeah.
I was thinking, though, the Hollywood Babylon thing, that was at the Lovitz. That's how long ago that was.
John Lovitz.
I'm an asshole. Thank you.
Thank you.
I don't miss that. And then you guys worked there for a minute with your podcast as well.
Yeah, the About Last Night podcast was there for a second, but then I wanted to take all the money.
Give me your money.
What have you earned? It's mine.
Yeah.
10%, no.
And then he's out of the business. So,
yeah, so sometimes karma works.
Yeah. Let's start at the beginning. You're a local kid, and I mean local to where we are right now, which is Southern California. Orange, right? Is that where you grew up?
Orange County. I was born at St. Joe's Hospital in Orange.
Orange?
So, yeah, and then I grew up in the city of Fullerton. Which, if you're listening to this all over the country, it's pretty much right next to Anaheim. Disneyland adjacent.
Right.
That was my first job. Disneyland.
You worked at Disneyland?
Yeah.
Well, I guess sort of, you know, it seems like a rite of passage. Almost everybody down there at one point or the other works for the mouse, right?
Yeah, you have to. The best part was that my job was, I was not one of the seven, which is what some
everybody
people
goes
assume.
To that, I'm
yeah,
sure.
Yeah. My actual job was a bodyguard for the characters. They call it a character host.
Ah.
So I'd walk around with them. You know, if a 5-year-old steps on a line, I throw a mean forearm shiver.
Well, that's kind of a fair fight at that point,
yeah,
I guess, right?
Yeah, at that point. Now, if some of the teenagers or the adults get rowdy, then I'm sorry, Minnie, you're fucked.
Sorry, Pluto's on his own.
The craziest story was one time. And this speaks to how when people go to Disneyland, they suspend their belief that that anything bad can ever happen to them. They think, well, I'm at Disneyland. I'm the happiest place on earth. It's protected.
Right.
Disney is our overlords. Nothing bad will happen. So I was with Mickey Mouse one day, and Mickey is half hour on, half hour off. So, and then I go in and get another Mickey Mouse. I mean, no. I mean, there's
one only
Mickey
one
Mouse.
Mickey.
I mean, and I would say things like, well, Mickey has to go get a quick glass of lemonade, and then he'll be right back.
Right.
And so this family comes up and is very just like, Mickey, want a photo. And I go, hey, like, I have to take, and this was a particularly hot day, so I'm like, I have to take Mickey. You should get a quick glass of lemonade, but be right back. Stay right here, and in a minute, you will have your photo. You will be the first one to get the photo with the brand new, refreshed Mickey Mouse. So, and they just keep begging, Mickey, photo. And I'm like, I'm chugging Mickey, and Mickey's squeezing my wrist, which is the signal to get me the F out of here.
Right. And, you can curse, by the way. It's a podcast.
Okay.
My kid's not around.
Yeah, shit, piss, fuck, cocks, motherfucker, tits. Okay, got through it. So then I'm dragging Mickey away, and then the mom in the family yells out, Mickey, like really loud, Mickey. Mickey turns. This mother takes her baby, throws the baby.
No way.
Lobs the baby, and Mickey just puts out his arms and catches the baby. They grab a quick photo, grab the baby, yell out gracias, and then book it.
Wow.
And I then grabbed Mickey and took Mickey backstage to get her lemonade. And Mickey pulls off her head, and she is sobbing.
I can imagine. She's been so rattled.
Yeah, because she's like, what if I dropped the baby? I'm like, but you didn't drop the baby, so you're fine. Everything's good.
Nice hands, Mickey.
Disney magic worked. But, like, yeah, that was the craziest part where someone threw their baby. And, like, I have a dog, and I wouldn't throw the dog. Like, I can't imagine having a baby under a year old and just being like, ah, fuck it. It'll be
and
right.
the visuals inside that head cannot be great, right?
Not good. Oh, I've tried on the thing. You have the mouth, and so you're staring like down, and that's it.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I have claustrophobia issues, so I can't imagine what those people go through on a summer's day in Disneyland with those costumes on.
Yeah. If it's up to 90 degrees, then they start cutting down the time to like 25 minutes, 20 minutes. If it gets over 105, nobody goes out.
Really?
Yeah. So if it's over 105, no, you will not see any, not face characters, but any heads.
Like fully costume characters.
Yeah,
gotcha.
Yeah. You'll see the face characters because they don't have the big head on them.
So the princesses will be around.
Yeah.
But,
yeah. Oh, they can't take the princesses away. There would be riots in Main Street if you don't let someone have their picture with Aurora.
As a father of an 8-year-old girl who went through a hardcore Disney princess phase, it is crazy how much passion that particular part of the franchise generates.
And I would say, as someone that worked in the park, the target audience, which was your daughter a few years ago, aren't the most passionate fans.
No?
The most passionate fans are the middle-aged men that come to Disneyland.
That's disturbing on so many levels.
There was a guy, and we called him Mr. Tuesday, because he was there, as you would imagine, every Tuesday.
So he was a pass holder.
Yeah, he was a pass holder. And he was never mean. He was never disrespectful, but he was there every Tuesday to get his photo with every princess. That was his routine.
Wow.
And he would do it. He never missed a Tuesday.
That's creepy as fuck. Yeah,
right? Like,
because you just know at home he's got those pictures just
he's got like
spattered.
Yeah, pretty much like every... Like, you know,
that's
the
why
scene,
he needs new ones.
Yeah, you know the scene from Ace Ventura where Ace comes into the Ray Finkel den? It's right, that. They're just photos and strings lining between people and newspaper headlines.
Oh, man.
Yeah, and there would be not just Mr. Tuesday, but there would be other middle-aged men that when they would come, they'd be like, hey, where's Princess Aurora today? And I'd be like, well, Aurora. And I've got to keep
she's
the magic
sleeping.
Going.
She's Sleeping Beauty, for God's sakes. That's where she is.
I've got to explain that. See the face characters. They're only available for a certain part of the day. So later in the day, they're not available, or certain ones aren't.
Right.
Because there's only one person that plays Snow White a day, one person that plays Aurora a day.
Oh, really? They don't shift those characters
because they don't want people to see slightly different faces. So
makes sense.
So you go and you see that face, and now
so all day long, when you run to her again, there she is again.
They might be in the other park, or they might be in a parade, but they're not going to be the character that's actually out.
Gotcha.
So I didn't expect this to turn into a Disney that Disney expose
we're
podcast.
Ripping the cover off
I
Disney.
Am never going to be in a Marvel movie now. Damn it! But when the middle aged men would come and ask like, hey, where's Princess Aurora today? I'd have to be like, ah, she's sleeping, or you know, she's on a date with the prince or whatever, and they would be furious.
Wow,
furious!
It's the whole adult Disney hardcore super fan thing to me is a little out of whack. I think
there's a screw loose. Absolutely,
the ones who are fighting over the pins and stuff.
Oh, pin people! Oh, sweet Jesus, the pin people!
When I go with my kid, I watch the adults and I go, "Wow, this is." And look, you're talking to a guy who's got a room full of Batman toys. So for me to accuse anyone of an arrested childhood or arrested adolescence is way out of line. Yeah. But I like to think I keep it within the normal parameters of adulthood.
Yes.
But the hardcore fans who, like you said, who are passionate about getting the pins and the stuff and finding the missing lost Mickeys and the hidden Mickeys and stuff, I just say, how do they... How do they find the time and energy to fill up their life with all that and also hold down a job or also have a relationship, whether they do or not?
Maybe, or have a family or whatever. I mean, but there were couples that would go to Disneyland every day of the year. Every day. They would show up, and even if it was just for an hour, even if it was to see one parade, even if it was because they just got a Google alert that there's a new type of cookie in one of the fucking bakeries. Which you think, like, who are those people? They're out there.
Hell yeah.
And like you say, you have your Batman. I'm a huge fan of the Denver Broncos, but I never want to get to the point where if the Broncos lose a game, then my wife has to, like, huddle in the corner and be afraid of what I'm going to do that day.
Right.
You know what I mean? Yes. Or if there's a funeral that happens to be on the day of the game, I'm not like, well, sorry, I'm not going.
Or, I'm not bringing them back to life, so there's no point.
Exactly. I never want to be that kind of fan of anything.
Right.
I want to be a fan and collect autographs and have photos or you have pieces of memorabilia. That's fine, but it's not consuming your life.
Emotional perspective is important.
It's not everything. If your daughter fell down and bruised herself, but then they only had five new Batmobiles left on eBay, you wouldn't be like, hold on,
right? This auction's almost over. Just put pressure on it.
Yeah, exactly. Not like this is a 66 cod piece. I have to have this.
Oh, I would like that.
Adam West's junk was in this cod piece. I need this in my life. Yeah.
So, other than Disney, how long did you work for Disney?
3 years.
3 years.
Yeah.
Other than that, what was childhood like in Orange County in the day? I mean, I can imagine it was fairly idyllic.
Yeah, it was pretty great. A lot of comics are scarred, ripped up, torn
up. A lot of damage.
Spat out people. Yeah. I'm not. Parents are still together. They love each other. They love us. My dad was a lawyer. My mom's a housewife. Middle to upper middle class upbringing in Orange County. So,
no trauma, no abuse, no nothing.
No bad uncles. I'm pretty good. And the only sort of damage I could say that I had, which is not much, but just being a dwarf, a little person, there would be obviously stares and comments and things like that.
Right.
But my dad pretty much equipped me to handle that because he would make fun of me as a child, but he would do it in the sense of like, all right, I just made fun of you, hit me back with something.
Hmm.
So make fun of me back. So and he would do that like age 3. So he trained me. So by the time I got to school and kids would make fun of me, I would have jokes and comebacks just ready.
Wow, what an interesting parenting technique.
Yeah, he thought that, well, my kid, and my parents are not dwarves, just to let people know, so it's not, you know, we don't all come from the same tribe.
We're not raising them on a farm somewhere in Orange County?
No? Yeah, so my dad's thought was, my son is going to be bullied, so rather than ignore the problem or be like, I'm going to, you know, just go get a teacher, you know, or something like that, he's like, no, I'm going to arm him. And I literally got sent to the principal's office on the first day of school because a kid said, ha ha, you're little. And I said, ha ha, your mom doesn't live with your dad anymore. And I was, I live in Southern California where that you got a 50-50 shot of getting that one right.
Yeah,
so,
really?
It was right, and apparently it was recent. So
And it landed.
So I got sent to the principal's office that day, and then the principal called my dad at work. And my dad was like, awesome. Like, he was not mad. He was just, like, thrilled.
It's kind of genius when I think about it. I mean, it would never dawn on me, but what a great way to prepare a kid for the real life experiences.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of people would say, I'm sure there's a lot of educators out there would say, well, if you just teach your son that he's fine just the way he is and you give him emotional security and confidence, those comments won't bother him. But I don't buy that. I think it would have to bother anybody,
right? Yeah, and I think they're part right when they say that. Teach your kid that they're fine the way they are in their own eyes.
Right.
But understand that other people are going to have questions and maybe you're not fine to them. But then, you know, so either teach them to come back or teach them that opposition will be coming.
Mm-hmm.
That that their life is not going to be all sunshine and lollipops.
Yeah, in the real world, there are assholes, and the things will be said.
Yeah, now, and I don't want people to think that my dad was just always insulting me. He would tell me why he's doing this, and he'd be like, I love you. You know I love you, but hit me back with something. So, and he would, like, so I would write jokes back to him. He was training me to become a comedian. He had no idea.
Right, right. That's crazy.
Yeah. So then, yes, then by the time I got to school and I'd be made fun of, I would make fun of the kid. And if there was any new kids in school, they would be like, okay, I got to look for someone that I can, like, they would look for someone to bully so they would be accepted. And they would look at me like, oh, great, the midget. All right, great. I'm going to go bully the midget. So then they'd go bully me, and then I would jump on them. The whole school would jump on them. Like, we love Brad. Like, so that was pretty cool, too.
That's awesome.
Yeah, played youth sports. You know, like, my dad didn't, like, my parents didn't hide me away or anything like that.
You weren't insulated. You just had a, you just were a kid.
Yeah, I just was a kid. It was fantastic. Yeah, so childhood was great. I got no complaints about mine.
When did your interest in performing start to bubble up? Was that something you wanted to do from a young age, or was there a moment that you remember, like, a light bulb went off and said, oh, this is something I could do?
I don't remember any specific, like, there wasn't like an aha moment.
Mm-hmm.
I always wanted to be a performer of some way, shape, or form. Back when I was like in like 7 or 8, I was a huge wrestling fan, and I would like videotape my own wrestling promos, like not the matches. Some guys would like be jumping off beds and like, you know, crashing onto pillows.
Like the Mean Gene interviews,
yeah,
that part?
Yeah, I'd be like, you know, I'd put rubber bands around my arms like the Ultimate Warrior had. And I would try to cut promos like Hulk Hogan. This is where the power lies, brother. Let me tell you something. Billy down the street. Oh, man, dude. When he gets in the squared circle with me. Like, and I'd be doing stuff like that. So, and this was to nobody. There's no audience.
Was there a camera or a mirror or anything?
Yeah. there was the voices in my head. There was a camera and that I'd record, and one of those big like old school. You see, kids, before we didn't have video cameras.
Before you could make a movie on your phone, you used to have a thing called a video camera.
It's basically like the size of a modern bazooka.
It's true.
That
you
throw on your shoulder. There are millions of dads out there that had to have like a rotator cuff surgery.
Remember the ones that used to hold the actual VHS tape?
Yeah.
You would slide it in there and close it up and just record right on that, like, sucker.
Yeah. So I'd set that up and do that. The aha moment when it came to stand up comedy was when a friend of mine showed me Eddie Murphy Raw when we were in high school, and just seeing Eddie Murphy be that damn funny. And people were like, and then I looked up his age, and at the time he was like 21.
Yeah.
Like 22. And at the time I was like 14 going, wait, that's in 7 years? He's selling out Madison Square Garden in 7 years. And seeing that made me go, oh, okay, that's something I might be able to do. I didn't realize that Eddie Murphy is a once in a generational talent,
right?
One thing that I think is important for anyone getting into show business is a certain naivete of not knowing the odds.
Ignorance truly is bliss when you get into the entertainment business. You're absolutely right.
It's Han Solo. Never tell me the odds. And because if you told me when I was starting to go into stand-up comedy, hey, this many people try this, this many people get to this level, this many people get to this level, and this quarter of a percentage get to the point where they can make a living doing this, comfortable living.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like – and it's funny because when I tell people that I'm a stand-up comedian who aren't in show business, they go like, oh, so who writes your jokes? Like they think that you just show up to the show business building,
mm-hmm,
and you go to the stand-up comedy wing, and they go, oh, you want to be a stand-up comic? All right, here's your jokes, here's your agent, here's your –
You get like, cast.
Yeah, exactly, and that's just not how it goes. And if someone told you when you start doing stand-up, like, no, you have to do open mic nights in front of nobody – That will lead to nothing.
But and you have to suck for a while before you get any good.
You got to suck for a long time. Some headliners still suck today. But you have to be horrible. You will bomb. It's not if what will you do if you bomb? It's when you get no laughs and you're standing up there going, ah, all
right. And then do you go back again? I guess that's the test, right?
Yeah. And
that weeds out a lot of people, I can imagine.
I've found that a lot of people that kept up with it had a great set the first time, their very first time they got laughs. And then the second time they did not get laughs. They did the same material. And they're like, well, what the hell happened? What was different? And now you're chasing the dragon.
Mm-hmm.
And now you're trying to figure out, like, okay, what did I do that first time
right.
that was so great? And this time that's that same words, shit. Like, what happened there?
And then there are the delusional ones who were never any good and never will be any good and just will not fucking give up the ghost when it comes to this ridiculous dream.
I remember my first open mic night. You talk about those guys. My first open mic night ever was at the Laugh Factory in Hollywood. I would not advise anyone go to that open mic night first.
It's because, a little advanced,
yes,
right?
There's consequences because the owner of the Laugh Factory, Jamie Masada, he watches you, and if you suck, and that's the very first impression that he has of you, he's going to think you suck for years.
Yeah.
Even if you're good.
That makes sense.
Yeah. So do other things first. But I did
suck
the
in a coffee shop first.
Yeah.
Before you go.
Yeah. As long as you can. Get laughs in the Mexican restaurant when you're competing with Monday Night Football. then go to the comedy store. Then go to the Laugh Factory. So I go there and there's this guy in line. You have to sign up at like 2 o'clock and then the show is at 5. But you start lining up at like 11. So I'm lining up there, and this guy goes, hey, man, you're new? And I go, yeah, yeah. And he goes, all right, just follow me, do whatever I do. I'll show you how to do this. I've been doing these open mic nights for 8 years. And I'm like, well, I don't want to do what you do then.
I hope to be further along in 8 years.
I don't want to be an open mic or in 8 years doing the same. Coming in at 11 a.m. on a Tuesday to sign up and wait in line for 3 hours before you get a spot. No, I don't want to do that.
Yeah.
So yeah, I still remember the guy. Well, I don't remember his actual name, but his name on stage was Burger, not Hamburger. That's a different comic who's actually successful. Burger, just Burger.
If you got a shticky name to begin with, that's never a good sign.
No.
Really.
My other favorite guy that was there all the time in the open mic scene was this guy named Fancy Ray. And Fancy Ray was a middle-aged African-American gentleman who looked like shit when he signed up. And then when he came back for the show, he'd have this sparkly pink shirt. No buttons were buttoned, maybe the bottom two. His gut was not what it was back in the day, maybe, when he was a little handsomer. Uh-huh. And he would gel up his hair, like, spiked, and then he would put glitter on his face.
Wow.
And he'd come up, and he'd go on stage and go, I am the best-looking man in comedy. That was his tag for every joke that went horribly wrong.
Oh.
So he would bomb and then say, I am the best-looking man in comedy.
I get flop sweats just hearing the stories.
Oh, there's a guy that's still at the Comedy Store. He's there every night. His name is Boone Shakalaka, not Boom, Boone, B-O-O-N.
Gotcha.
And he's got one great joke, and I love it. Every other joke sucks, but he's kind of effeminate, and he goes on, and he's also African American gentleman, and he goes on stage and goes, "What's 8 inches and white? Not a damn thing." Which is great. Good joke.
I'm Boone Shakalaka. Good night, everybody.
Yeah, that's a good joke. But then he does a lot of other jokes that are not good. So, but he's there every night, and he sells to make a living to encourage his show business dreams. Still, at probably the age of, now that I'm looking at him, and he's in his 50s.
Mm.
He sells T-shirts that we don't know where he got them. Maybe he made them. Maybe he stole them.
Maybe they fell off a truck.
Yeah, whatever. It's fine. Yeah, go say hi to Boone Shakalaka when you go to the Comedy Store. He's great.
Did you start, when you saw Eddie Murphy at 14, did you start working on it then, or did that come later?
I started, it was in my lexicon. It was in my, it was in my wheelhouse that, okay, I could probably do this.
Okay, and, so you're conscious now of that as a potential.
Right. And then I started doing, there's an improv comedy thing at my high school. We had an improv comedy team.
Wow.
Called it's Comedy Sports, and it still exists today in high schools all over America, and it's great. And basically, Comedy Sports is the Whose Line Is It Anyway games,
mm-hmm.
you know, in different versions of that.
Right.
And it was great. It was a lot of fun. We put on shows at lunchtime and got the kids to watch us, and we did shows at night for our parents, and they sold pretty well. And looking back, the scenes were really fun. I once made my mother faint during a show. We were playing a game called Forward Reverse, where you're doing the scene, and then at some point the referee yells out "reverse," and you have to do whatever you were doing backwards. You don't have to talk backwards, but you do the
physically.
You do the physics. And so the trick of the game is that while you're doing the scene, you do outrageous physical action. That when the ref says "reverse," you go, "Oh crap!"
Right.
Even though you knew that's what you had to do. So my friend, ironically, the same friend that introduced me to Eddie Murphy Raw, he and I were big wrestling fans. As you can tell, I'm a wrestling fan, and he during the scene picks me up and gives me a pile driver.
Oh Lord!
Which we knew how to do, and we were good at it. But it looked very real. And the way I was very light, he is a larger gentleman. So when he gave me the pile driver, he was able to kind of throw me. So it looked like the ground, like, popped. Like, I hit the ground like a spring, popped up, and landed. And then I didn't move. And my mother was in the audience, and she saw that, and she fainted.
Oh, I can imagine.
And then the ref actually said the words, "God help me. Reverse." And then I popped up and it was fine, but then someone yelled out from the audience, "Your mom fainted." So that's where I got into like performing comedy and scene work and yes and that kind of stuff. And then stand-up didn't happen until when I was 19 years old, Father's Day weekend. I go to the Brea Improv to see your favorite comedian Carlos Mencia perform. You love that man. I know you know all his albums.
Yeah, huge fan.
And Mencia's on stage, and he starts making midget jokes. Now he doesn't know I'm in the audience. He starts making midget jokes. Half the audience is laughing, and the audience that's sitting by me is like, they're not laughing. They're just,
right.
And they're like pointing over. And Mencia notices and he goes, "What? These jokes kill. What the fuck?" And he goes, "What? Is one of them here?" And I just raised my hand and he goes, "Holy shit. One of them is here." And he called me up on stage. So I go up on stage and he starts asking me questions. And I answer them honestly. My answers got laughs. I wasn't trying to be funny, but he said, like, "What do you do for a living?" At the time, Disneyland.
Mm-hmm.
So, and that got a laugh, and I used the line, "No, I wasn't one of the seven." I talked about being a bodyguard, and like all that was getting laughs. And like I said, wasn't trying. And that was the moment where I go, "Oh, this is what I want to do."
Wow.
This is what, and that's when I signed up. The next day, I signed up for the open mic night at the Laugh Factory. And that was when I was 19. That was 15 years ago.
And that started a relationship with you and Mencia,
right?
Yeah.
He had just gotten the pilot for Mind of Mencia on Comedy Central. He threw me on the pilot episode, and then I was a cast member on that show. I was a writer on that show at age like 23, 24. It was great. It was a great experience. I was a guy that toured with him. I was his opening act for 4 years. That was sort of like my version of comedy college.
Mm.
And then I will say this, because when I was on the Joe Rogan podcast, people are that famous feud, and I was worried that his fans would automatically hate me because I was Mencia's boy. So I went on there and I said this was, and this is not what I'm not making this up. I'm not trying to. This is truly what I believe. There are you'll find out as you get older in this world, people aren't all good or all bad. There's various shades of gray. It's just where they fall on that scale.
Right.
You can tell me that what the stuff you've seen about Mencia, I will never be able to convince you otherwise, whether I believe it or not. And I don't think anyone could. But I will say this. The man took me as not even an open micer, an unknown, and took me on the road because after I started doing stand-up, I saw Mencia again a year and a half later. He remembered me from the show, and he said, hey, you're that guy that said you want to do stand-up comedy. I go, yeah. He goes, have you started doing it? And I go, yeah, I've been doing it for a year and a half, been doing open mic nights. He goes, great, open up my show tonight. And that was in front of 400 people at the Ontario Improv.
Wow.
And I had just been doing coffee shops before then in the Laugh Factory. I went on stage, did my set. I got off stage. Mencia goes on and goes, and he asked the audience, he goes, did you guys like Brad? And everyone goes, yeah. And he goes, all right, you guys just made a decision for me. My current opening act is ready to go on, ready to move out and start headlining. So and he called out from stage. He goes, Brad, you want to be my new opening act? And I go, yeah. The next week, I was in Bakersfield at the Fox Theater, which is 1,200 people.
And wow.
I was doing that the next week. So, like, any opinions that you have about the man, that's fine.
Mm-hmm.
But also know that he took me as an unknown on the road, sort of taught me the ropes. He would pay for my flight. He would pay for my meals. If ever we were at a mall, he'd say, hey, whatever you're getting, throw it onto my pile. I got you. And he was vital in my development as a stand-up comedian.
Well,
so,
sure, sounds like.
Yeah, so you can have your opinions, and that's fine. And but just know that there's shades of gray to people. And I think we're finding that out, especially now, especially with like the Me Too movement, where
yeah,
people where we're like, yeah, they're our heroes. Oh, they're not.
And not everybody treats everybody the same way either. You
yeah.
know, somebody who's really, like you said, has a feud with someone or is shitty to someone may not behave that way in a different circumstance
yes.
or a different relationship. You
exactly.
never know. You never
yeah.
know how people act.
Yeah.
So that's fair.
Yeah. So that was it. I was his opening act for 4 years, was on the show after about 4 years. I used what little fame I had from the show to sort of parlay that into touring stand-up comedy. But I'll tell you this, you are responsible for one of my breaks.
Yeah, let's talk about how we kind of met. And quite frankly, I'm glad we're having this conversation because I'm a little fuzzy on the details.
Oh.
I remember.
I know it.
I remember you being at the one of our live radio events, the Miss Double December pageant.
Yes.
Was that the first time we met?
That was the first time we met. The Double December pageant.
And for those who are listening, who are around the world, who aren't familiar with my radio stuff, when I used to be on this morning show on KROQ here in Los Angeles, they would have an annual event called the Miss Double December pageant, which was it was basically us trying to stern it up a little bit, where we'd get a collection of really attractive women, and we'd have sort of a faux beauty pageant every December. And then the woman who won was sort of our spokesmodel for the year, and she'd get to attend all the live concert events, and she'd be on the show. And it was a mutually beneficial relationship where she got to be part of the morning show crew, and we got someone who wasn't hideously ugly like the rest of us in the morning to put in pictures and things like that.
Yeah, exactly.
So that was the premise behind it.
Yeah, and it was done at a place called the Slide Bar in Fullerton, which at the time I was living across the street from the Slide Bar. And I had been a fan of the show for a while, and I thought, like, well, I'm going to go. And I went, and I took my the guy that was dating my sister at the time. Now he's my brother-in-law. He married her, made an honest woman out of her. and so we're talking, and he somehow, I still to this day I don't know how he did this. He finagled us backstage. I don't know how. All the guys are trying to get backstage because the girls are there, and but I don't know how we got backstage. And then it comes the moment where we're about to, when you're about to crown the Miss Double December, and I'm standing there with Kevin from the morning show,
right?
And I don't know how I got next to him, but I just look at him. I go, "Hey, do you think it'd be funny if when you crown the winner, I run up on stage and hump her leg?" And Kevin, who if you're familiar with his work, he loves chaos.
Yes,
he goes, yeah, that should absolutely happen. Now, he doesn't know me. I'm just a guy from the audience.
Right.
He doesn't know if I've...
You could be Mr. Tuesday for all we know.
Exactly. And so I go, all right. So, and now, I don't think he told any of you guys. I don't.
He told me.
Oh,
he told me.
Okay,
I knew it was
MC.
Coming because I was emceeing the event. Right. I used to host it and MC it, and so I think he needed me to know what like, was going to happen, so I didn't tackle you or
so
something.
So you didn't kick me in the head.
Yeah, exactly.
So the winner was announced. I ran up on stage. Great radio.
Dwarf humping, a little visual for radio.
A dwarf humping a hot girl's leg, and that kind of it got an extra little pop. From the audience,
from the live audience,
yeah, they really liked it. We hung out afterward, and we talked a little bit, and I think that's when you had just started Hollywood Babylon,
right?
And not at the Smod Castle. You had just sort of moved on and started doing it at the Lovitz Club,
right? And again, for those who don't know the history, John Lovitz from Saturday Night Live used to own a comedy club up at Universal Studios. They've got like a little area of shops and restaurants and things like that called City Walk, and he had a brand new comedy club up there, and Kevin Smith and I had just moved there to start doing our show.
Yeah, that was before he was ripping you off. Or maybe, or maybe as he was ripping you off.
I think it was always, but we just didn't catch him until about a year later.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So I start showing up to those Hollywood Babylon Live podcasts. And I remember I brought you a bottle. No, it goes back before that, because then after the Double December thing, you started. I tweeted at you, and you started following me on Twitter.
Yes.
And then every now and then you would retweet some of my jokes that I would post, which at the time when I had like 700 followers, like it was nothing. That was insanely valuable because you had followers, it seems like, from day one. And that got me a lot of followers and a lot of notice, and those tweets got out to a greater audience. So to thank you for retweeting me and introducing me to so many people, I showed up to one of the Hollywood Babylon podcasts, and I brought you a bottle of whiskey. I think I bought you a bottle of nice whiskey, but you don't drink nice whiskey.
No, I think it was scotch.
Scotch, that's right, yes.
So you brought me scotch, and that's the only whiskey I don't drink is scotch. I drink everything else but scotch.
Yeah.
That's right.
Yeah, yeah. I got you some nice like Irish scotch. And you're like, just Jack is fine. Well,
there's no Irish scotch, Brad. It's Irish whiskey or there's scotch whiskey.
Oh, scotch, yeah.
They're different countries, for God's sake.
That's pretty obvious. I should know that. it's like saying, oh, it's Japanese Chinese food.
That's right. But didn't you know Gabby Zamora too, the manager of the place?
Yeah, and
I think
Frank
that was
Kelly.
Another connection that we had is because you had gotten. I don't know if they had booked you there yet, whether you had performed there or not. But I knew Gabby was friendly with you.
Yep.
And so I was getting friendly with her at the time. Eventually, Gabby became my assistant and then the producer of Hollywood Babylon when she left the Lovitz.
Yeah.
But I know she was also a huge fan of yours and kept suggesting that we get you on the Kevin and Bean show.
Yeah, and that also to make this full circle, Frank Kelly ran the John Lovitz Comedy Club, and Frank was the manager of the Ontario Improv the night that I went up.
Wow.
For Mencia.
How incestuous this all is.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So that whole thing. And so I brought you the bottle and I believe you said, we should get you on the morning show sometime. Like, thank you for the bottle. Thanks for being funny on Twitter. We'll get you on the morning show sometime. Fast forward to, I think I had a day at the Bray Improv that I needed to promote. Texted you or tweeted you or whatever and said, hey, can I come on the morning show to promote this? You said, yeah, I'll run it by the guys. They let me on, and apparently I did well on my very
first
appearance.
You did immediately. The listeners took to you immediately.
Yeah, and because I remember when we were done with the segment, you looked at me and went, Jesus, are you busy in April? Which was a reference to the April Foolishness comedy show that you guys did every year.
Right.
I immediately got booked on April Foolishness based on the first radio show appearance. And I don't know, there was a combination of just being a local guy, being a fan of the show, so I knew the isms of the show, which definitely helps you.
Sure, yeah.
So you can come
you
on.
You can fit right in, and the minute you land, you're running.
I go, all right, that guy's the creepy guy, that guy's the nutbag, and this guy's the angry guy. Cool, got it.
Right.
And then she's sweet. Okay, perfect.
Right.
I got it. Fast forward to the April Foolishness show, where and the lineup was insane. The lineup was Bob Saget, Tim Minchin, Bill Burr, Jay Moore, Eddie Izzard, like just an insane lineup, and then this guy Brad Williams that no one knows who the hell he is. And at the end of my set, I was on third, which is a little bit of cheating because it's the kill spot. I brought out the I can say her name, right? It's cool.
Yeah, sure.
Yeah, yeah. I brought out Lisa May, who is the female on the morning show at the time. I brought her out and gave her a lap dance in front of everyone at the Gibson Amphitheater, which holds like, I don't know, a few thousand people.
Yes.
And got a standing ovation. And Jay Moore was next.
Oh, I remember. He was pissed.
He was so mad. And he walks out, and the first line he says is, okay, before I go on, just know that after Brad Williams, we're all playing for second place.
Yeah.
And that line coming from Jay Moore really... I heard it backstage and went, oh, shit. Like, that's cool. And then I remember the next day on the morning show or that Monday, you guys called me up and was like, hey, what's it like to know that you had the set of the night at April Foolishness? And people heard that. And that got me to sell tickets in Los Angeles.
Oh, great.
Which any comic will tell you, it is insanely hard to sell tickets in Los Angeles and New York because everything's there. Why would I go see this comic that I don't know when I could go, like, when Larry David's doing something at the Largo tonight?
There's too much to do.
So much every night.
Yeah.
So that got me to sell tickets in Los Angeles. So that was the next stepping stone in the career, and you were the base of that. Thank you, sir.
Glad I could come in handy.
Yeah. It worked out. And, like I said, I've always been a fan of yours since...
Now get me a job.
Yeah, I'm working on it. I'm actually working on it. But to this day, whenever I do an impression of anything on any radio show or podcast, I always say shout out to Ralph Garman because all my impressions are impressions of your impressions.
Well, that's okay. My impressions are impressions of other people's impressions. So everybody steals.
Yeah, exactly. And I'm just doing my. I don't know how to do some of these impressions, but then it's so weird how you cannot know what to do, and then you hear someone else do it, and you know and you just go, oh.
Yeah,
that's the impression.
Mm-hmm.
Like that's the inflection, whether it be Frank Caliendo. No one knew how to do a Charles Barkley impression until he went terrible.
Right,
and once he said terrible, now we that's the thing, and now we all get it locked in.
Yeah,
or you doing the Ed Wynn voice and me just going oh my goodness, and that thing like kind of sparks you off or whatever the key word or note or thing is. I've just noticed that a lot of my favorite impressionists, yourself included, don't just do the voice. It's everything.
You have to sometimes to get the voice out. You have to sort of embody the person. You have to do the face or a physical mannerism or something that helps you get there.
Yeah, that sort of like launches you into it. And I love when you do your Al Pacino because your eyes get wide and you start.
Oh
like,
yeah. Yeah, he
and you start doing it with your like the thing with your mouth that he does. It's crazy.
It's automatic. I can't do one without doing the other because largely, I mean, and I'm not a great impressionist. There are guys out there like you mentioned Caliendo, and there's guys who are just brilliant. That's what they do. That's their thing. I'm a guy who I'm not really a comedian either. I'm not much of anything. I just go out occasionally and through a combination of different attempts, I'm able to make some people laugh sometimes. So you use whatever you got. And having an acting background, I find my impressions are more sort of caricatures than they are vocal impressions. You know, so I end up doing the whole performance just because that's the only way I can get it out.
Well, like we were lucky enough to get Dana Carvey on the About Last Night podcast, the podcast that I do. And he said that the secret...
Before you go on, real quick, as an aside, I don't want to miss that plug. If you guys aren't listening to About Last Night, it's Brad and Adam Ray. Yeah. They do it together. It's very funny, and it's a great conversation always. So wherever you get your podcast from, go find that one as well.
Thank you very much for the shout-out. Go back all the way to the very first one, and you will hear Ralph Garman.
Did I do the very first one?
Very first one.
Wow, that's crazy.
You did the
crazy.
Very first podcast.
Well, I think it's time for me to come back, for God's sake. I did
think
the first
so, too.
One. That's had, a long time
we've
ago.
We've had 400 episodes since
really.
Then. We should have you back.
Let's catch up.
So we had Dana Carvey on, and he said the secret to a good impression is to just say who you are before you start doing the voice.
That's funny.
And then everyone and the example he gave is, I'm about to do a Glenn Close impression. I'm Glenn Close. Okay. Yeah, right. And you'll believe it. Yeah. Cuz you just have that person in your head. So if no one really knows what Glenn Close sounds like. Right. So you can just say that.
That's funny.
And it works, or you say a line from their movie, yeah, or whatever.
That's the key. But you're right. It is easier if you find something to hang your hat on. Like for me, it was ooh-ah. That got me into Pacino. You know, there's one or two word phrases that you can say, all right, I can start there and then grow everything out from that.
Like from Harrison Ford, is it the mumble?
Yeah.
First?
Actually, no. It's the pause that Harrison does in an interview when he doesn't have an answer at the ready.
Oh, really?
He kills time with... Like that of his is always the thing that got me to, because he drops it all the time. If he's doing an interview, like, so how was the Blade Runner revisiting that character? Was it hard for you to get back into the skin of Rick Deckard? He'll always do that before he launches into something. So that's what I found that.
It's like his version of, you know.
Exactly.
It's
just something to kill time before he comes up with something.
That's really interesting.
Yeah.
I mean, and then you will, I'll continue to compliment you. I'm sure fun.
Oh, no. Yeah. Please don't. Stop.
Your improvisation with everything that you do on the podcast, the years on the radio show, and like, you went to the Groundlings, or were you?
No, I went to Acme Comedy Theater.
Acme.
I was with the Acme Comedy Troupe, which was a startup crosstown rival to the Groundlings that was originally started by expatriate Groundlings, people who had come out of that program and weren't quite satisfied with the way they were running the theater and kind of wanted to do their own thing. So they started a competing sketch and improv troupe across town.
Wow.
That's who I was with.
Okay.
So I got on the ground floor with that group, and that's where I met Carolla and all those people after that.
Yeah. And then did Carolla get you in with the morning show?
Jimmy Kimmel was sort of the driving force behind the morning show at the time.
He had
come up with the idea for the man show,
yes,
and he and Adam were going off to do that, and they needed someone to step in and fill that void. And Kimmel had seen me at the Acme Comedy Theater and knew me through Adam Carolla.
Oh,
and they put their heads together and they said, this guy who does voices and writes and can do improvisation, he probably would be a good stopgap until they found a permanent replacement for Jimmy. That was the plan.
And 18 years later, they still haven't found a replacement.
That was a 3-month gig that turned into 18 years. And I don't know if they still found a replacement. I don't know.
No, they still haven't. Yeah. And it's really interesting because just how like you said, a 3-month gig just turned into the thing that bought the lovely home that we're sitting in today.
Right.
You never
know how things are going to shake out.
You never know.
That's why you got to take every gig.
You really do, because you don't know what's going to be the gig that launches the thing that goes to the other.
You didn't
thing
think humping a girl's leg at a faux beauty pageant was going to lead you to Los Angeles radio, which would lead you to success locally, which would lead you to now comedy specials and touring around the country, and your success level has just been off the charts.
It's a little nuts, and as you know, this is because, like I kind of said earlier, no one ever comes up to you and says, like, hey, you're famous now.
Yeah.
Like, that doesn't happen. No. It's always a slow build,
mm-hmm,
and you're the same person that you were when you started coming into the business, and then all of a sudden, you get something that pops a little bit, and it's all like we say, you never know what it's going to be. I have people that come up to me that say, "Oh, we know you from Kevin and Bean," or mm-hmm, "I know you from the comedy specials," or now I've had a couple of bits go viral, or they say, like, oh, I know you from the show This Is Not Happening, where
I
told a story about playing in a celebrity golf tournament, and when I walked up to my cart, they had names of all the celebrities on the cart, and I walked up and Wee Man was on my cart.
Yes.
And then I faked being Wee Man for a day. I mean, many would say I've been faking being Wee Man for a lifetime.
You guys get confused for each other a lot, obviously, because you're both little people.
Yeah, and we had him on the About Last Night podcast recently, and
oh,
we revisited some of those stories. But yeah, so you never know what's going to be the thing.
Right.
There's a meme I was in. I don't know. You don't know. You don't. Now they threw my specials up on Amazon Prime, which is great because now people don't have to be subscribed to Showtime or whatever.
Right.
They can just watch them, and that's been helping out a lot. And people keep rediscovering. People watch my first special and go, holy crap. This special that came out this year, I'm like, mm-hmm. That was 5 years ago, and I got another one since then, and now a Netflix one that's coming.
Oh, really? Soon?
Later? Do you they don't tell me.
Oh, they don't?
It's filmed. It's done.
And they said yes, right?
Yeah, they said yes.
They're not changing their mind, no, so it'll be on at some point.
It'll be on at some point. They told me fall, so I'm hoping that it comes. Just I'll probably get a phone call and just. At some point, just go tomorrow.
They're probably trying to find room because they have so many comedy specials on Netflix.
Well,
you might not have enough bandwidth.
Yeah, we've got every cast member from Saved by the Bell. They're all releasing their own comedy special, hour long. So we got to fit you in between them and Good Times. it's madness.
Let me ask you, now that you've been in the business for what, 15 years?
Yeah, 15 years.
Obviously, and it made sense at the time, your jumping off point of view for your comedy was your size. Sure. And people's reaction to your size and how you coped and what mm-hmm. what those ridiculous circumstances would lead to in your
yes.
life.
Yes.
Do you ever get to a point where you say, I don't really want to do one more I'm little joke?
Every night of my life.
Really?
Here's the thing. And
let me just, yeah. I'll let you answer, but I just, like, for example, my friend yeah. Kevin Smith, who recently has lost a ridiculous amount of weight.
Yeah, looks great.
For a long time, he was a big, heavy guy.
Yeah.
And he accepted, and he worked it into his brand, and he became Fat Man on Batman, and yeah. he worked with that because that was his deal.
Right.
But when he lost the weight, he was happier to not have to deal with that and talk about that all the time. So I wonder if you, after 15 years, you would like to reach a point where it doesn't necessarily have to be about Lucky Charms Disneyland reaching stuff or anything.
Exactly.
Of that,
you know? Well, man, if there was a no sugar, no grain diet, that would shoot me up 2 feet.
Yeah, it's true. I mean, you're kind of stuck because you can't put on height.
No.
You know? You can't eat a ton and put on height.
No, can't. That,
so
that
that's
can't
always going to be there.
Yeah.
But I'm thinking maybe it doesn't have to be the focus so much on what
right.
you do anymore.
And if you look at the progression of my material, you'll see. If you go to my very first album, just a CD called Coming Up Short, that was just chock full of the dwarf jokes. And then gradually as you went to the next album and then the first special and then the second special. I mean, the cornerstone of the second special is me talking about my dad fighting skin cancer, which has nothing to do with me being a little person.
Right.
So it's slowly being phased out, but at the same time, I understand that that I have this thing that, like, everyone knows a fat guy. So eventually, you cannot do fat jokes. People go, yeah, I know what that life is.
Mm-hmm.
I'm familiar, and all the fat jokes have been told, and there have been many fat comedians or whatever the thing is, if you're a certain race, whatever. Not a lot of people know a lot of little people.
True.
It's a perspective that you're unfamiliar with, and so I'm done saying the Lucky Charm joke, the ooh, I could take a bath in a thimble joke. That's gone.
Mm-hmm.
But now it comes from like okay, like there's a part of my act now where I'm telling a story about how it's really odd to me that a lot of comics strive to get a standing ovation. I get a standing ovation when I put my own bag in the overhead storage bin. And this happened where I did it, not thinking like I'm going to do this and impress people. I just did it because that's life. And then I turned around and there was one guy, like the slow clapper from Not Another Teen Movie, just like. And then like other people joined in like, yeah, he did it. Oh, my God. And so now I'm exploring something of like one thing that no one ever tells you when you have a disability is that you can be inspirational for no fucking reason whatsoever.
And accidentally inspirational, yes. Without yes. even not performing trying. Anything you think no. is all that tough.
No, I drive. And people are like, he's driving. He's living his life. Right. Like, it's that. So that part's weird. So
And you do mine your own personal life when it comes to stand-up comedy. So yes. I guess those things will always be a part of
yeah.
you.
So, because, like I said, I don't know the perspective of a 5'9" white American male. I right. don't know that perspective. I will never have it. So I'll always have the dwarf perspective. So I'll always be like, well, I just got a dog who's a 70-pound pit bull. What's that like for a little person?
Right.
I'm sure when I have kids, it'll be like, what's that like for a little person? And it won't necessarily be, oh my God, I'm so tiny. But it'll be like, well, these are things you may have not have thought about, and you may not realize that I have to deal with, because I didn't realize I had to deal with this. So there will always be that, and there will always be people that are new to me and discovering me. So if I went on stage and talked for an hour about airline food and what the president
or
said,
politics, yeah.
Yeah, there'd be the whole audience just be like, does he know? Like, when's he going to get
someone
to the thing?
Tell him.
Yeah, when's he going to get to the thing? Like, they want to know. And every now and then I'll think, like, you know what? Maybe I'm done with dwarf jokes. Maybe I don't have to do dwarf jokes. And then something will happen where I'll post a photo of, like, just me and my wife at dinner on Instagram, and like every comment will be a dwarf joke. I'm
right.
like, all right, well, that's still how people view me. So it's kind of like,
you have to admit too, being a dwarf made mm-hmm. you unique and special in a field where there's a lot of people trying yeah. to get attention. So you have to recognize the fact that that's part of the reason people paid attention to you. Now, yeah. I was talking about this with, with Patton Oswalt when he did yeah. the show, that that's great when people pay attention, but the thing is, after that, is are you funny or not?
Yeah.
You got to deliver. It doesn't matter what your entree is into their yeah. world. You have to be funny, and you certainly yeah. are that. But I also wonder, like you said, people are waiting for it. There must be a certain percentage of your fan base too. It's like being a rock band, right? It's like yeah. being Springsteen and going on tour, but not doing Born to Run tonight.
Yeah.
So you kind of have to do the greatest hits, which is
yeah.
people want to hear that
yeah.
stuff from
people
you.
People want to hear the short jokes. That's funny. To your thing where you talked about Patton, where in terms of like now you got attention. I've seen other dwarf comedians.
Oh, really?
There are other dwarf comedians. And only one other one besides me would be, I would say, considered successful in stand-up. There are others that have gone on and done other things in the acting world or
right.
behind the scenes. But it's pretty much just me and a comedian named Tanya Lee Davis who mostly does stuff overseas. But she has her name up on the Comedy Store. I thought I was the first dwarf to ever have my name up on the Comedy Store wall. And then it's like, ah, fuck, Tanya Lee.
That's funny.
Yeah, I thought it was going to be like, I'm the Jackie Robinson of little people. Nope. Not
you guys
so much.
Should tour together sometime.
Right?
Well, double feature.
Yeah. I mean, the worry is once you see a half hour or 45 minutes of one dwarf stand up, then the other one's backstage going through their notes like, fuck, I can't do any
of
this shit.
Can't do that. Yeah, can't do that. That's
yeah.
funny.
Yeah. And I've had jokes. It's funny I say that because I had one time where a dwarf comic came up to me on the road. This was in Sacramento, California. And he said, I'm a big fan of yours. I started doing stand-up after I saw, you know, you do stand-up for the first time, and I'm really working at it. And so I wanted to pay it forward and kind of do the thing that Mencia did for me. It's like, okay, great, you do stand-up? Open up my show tonight. And the look he got on his face is just so excited
wow.
and so happy. And he goes, it's a sold-out crowd, and he's excited. And he goes on stage, and no joke, Ralph, did 7 minutes of my first album.
No
and just,
way.
He just did my jokes. And he goes and he gets off stage and he killed. And he
sure,
gets
it's
off
good
stage,
material.
And he gets off stage and I'm like, big fan, huh? He goes, yeah. He had no idea. He was so out of body, out of mind. Like, he didn't even know that he did.
You think
my
he
act.
Just absorbed your stuff
yeah.
and then sort of extrapolated
yeah.
it and made it his own.
And I understand that we were going to talk about similar things. So I'm not saying like, he said he was short. That's my deal. No,
right,
I'm
right,
not saying
right.
like, did the jokes. And I was just in the back like, wow.
Wow.
Well, okay.
Good thing you've got new material.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. If I was in the back like, shit, that's my best stuff. Close with a lap dance, son of a bitch.
Very cool of you to give that opportunity to somebody, though.
Oh, I give out guest spots like candy. If you come up to me on the road and you're a comedian and it's not your first time on stage, yeah, I'll throw you up there. Because I want you to it's important for an up and coming comic to get that opportunity, because if you don't put your material in front of an actual audience, if it's just the drunks at the bar that are watching the football game and then they turn off the game and say, "All right, comedy night." Mm-hmm. Like if it's just that, or if it's just other open micers that you're trying to make laugh, that's not a good gauge to know how your material is actually doing, if it's actually funny. So I want to give comics a chance, and there's been times where they've killed, and there's been times when they've bombed horribly, and they go, "Oh, that shit's not working."
But I wonder, do you ever get concerned when you're throwing a question mark up there in front of you that they might chill the room, or they might have an adverse effect on your night? I mean, it's a nice thing to do, but you don't want to poison the well either.
Yeah, and look at that. I'm sitting down with you.
Yes.
And Gino from Philly Steaks is calling me. Holy, that's irony.
Tell him I'll take a whiz wit.
Yeah, that's the Gino.
It's Gino from Gino's Steaks.
Yeah, well, and for the Philly crowd, it's the kid, not the actual guy that started it. Because the actual
Gino's
guy,
gone now.
Yeah, Gino's dead. So that would be a really weird phone call
from beyond. Gino Jr. just called you.
Yeah,
huh?
Wow. While I'm here with
what
the
is
Philly
your connection
boy.
With Gino's Steaks?
I did a show at the Helium Comedy Club in Philly. I go there every year, and Gino is a huge stand-up comedy fan, and he came to see me one time.
How awesome!
Liked me and said I got free steaks for life, and I was like, fuck yeah. So and I know you're a Jim's guy, which is great. And but now, like, because Gino came to my show and he let me go inside Gino's Steaks and sit at the VIP booth. There's a VIP booth inside.
I've heard
Gino's
tell
Steaks.
I've heard rumors of this place.
There's an autograph book. I got the sign next to Jack Nicholson.
Wow, not too shabby.
So I'm a loyal.
You're a Gino's guy. Fair enough.
Gino's guy. Now it is strange that when I'll go on stage and I'll usually plug Gino's, because you know he's a friend and he's helped me out and he's he brings steaks whenever he sees me. It's awesome. I'll say like, yeah, you know, and I'm in Philly, so you know I'm gonna go to Gino's Steaks, whatever. Some people cheer and some people just like, boo! I'll kill you! Like, they are, wow.
Well, the Philadelphians will kill anyone over almost anything. They disagree on most things, but it's a very personal thing to a Philadelphian where he gets his steaks from.
Absolutely. Yeah. And
I've been called a sellout because Jim's, although it is the preferred of, like, all the big names in town, it is sort of the locals' place.
Yeah.
Pat's and Gino's are more sort of the tourist locations.
Yeah.
But even I have been called out to be a sellout because Jim's is so well known. Like, there is a place on Passyunk that you have to know a guy and you knock on the back of the door and you go in and you got to know the code word. I was like, okay, I don't want to work that hard to get a steak. Yeah. I just want to stop by.
Now, I will ask you this, and maybe this is sacrilegious to ask someone this from Philadelphia. Is there a law of diminishing returns? Is there a time where it's like, at the end of the day, it's like, it's a steak? No,
not for me. Okay. Maybe for other Philadelphians, but not for me.
So, if you had a Pat's, a Gino's, and a Jim's, could you eat them and go, "That's Jim's, that's Pat's, that's Gino's"?
I don't know if I could identify them by where they came from, but I know I would prefer one over the others.
Wow.
For sure.
Okay, because for me as an outsider, I look at it like those commercials for Twix that are like left Twix, right Twix. Like, oh, no. We cascade our caramel. They flow their caramel.
We're the right
different side
completely.
Yeah, yeah, completely.
No, I
different.
Definitely have a preference when it comes to steaks. Yeah, I can definitely pick one out and say, yeah, this one, I enjoy this one much more than the others.
Okay, because I've talked to Gino and I said, like, hey, so what's the difference between you and Pat's? And he'd be like, oh, well, we dice our steak.
How they prepare the meat is a big part of it, yeah.
Okay. So that is an actual thing.
Yeah.
Okay,
yeah.
See, this is the stuff that I want to know.
Some pull it apart, some cut it, some just do the razor thin slices and grill them up as whole slices. There's
now,
a whole technique to it.
Are you a cheese whiz? Are you a provolone?
I'm a whiz guy.
Okay,
I like whiz wit, which means cheese whiz with grilled onions.
Yeah.
That's how I take my steak.
That is literally how I take mine as well. So yeah. I'm happy to know that I'm the same level.
Completely legit. Although, again, I do take shit from some people in Philadelphia who say, well, it's an Italian thing. You should put provolone on it. Some people like American cheese. I always say live and let live. For me, the taste-wise, I love the whiz. So.
Now, are you a guy that when someone says that they like pizza with pineapple on it, are they dead to you?
Yes. It's fucking hideous. At no time should fruit and tomato sauce ever be in the same meal. It just doesn't make any goddamn sense. Nobody gets a big bowl of grapes with marinara over it and sits there with a spoon. There's never been an opportunity for fruit, sweet fruit, and tomato sauce to be married. It makes no goddamn sense.
Okay, so if you're at a football party and they go, hey, we got pizza, we got a Hawaiian pizza, you're like, is your name Signungatuck? Because if it's not. No.
Yes.
You don't get to do that.
Right. All right, Moana. I'll order something for the rest of us.
I love that.
So what's the future hold for Brad Williams? What's the next step?
Oh, the next step.
You've conquered the stand-up world. Yeah. Do you want to act? Do you want to do movies and TV shows and stuff like that?
I've got
like
to
your
do...
buddy Adam Ray is always in every goddamn movie I see lately. He's working a ton.
He is. He's right now he's shooting an independent film with Thomas Lennon.
Good for him.
So he's killing it. He's in a bunch of stuff. I love doing stand-up. I never see a world where I'm not going to be doing stand-up. I hope to one day graduate up to like theaters so I just fly in, do one night instead of being in Omaha for a whole week. Don't get me wrong, Omaha, I love you, but
I just don't want to spend the week there.
I want to spend 3 days.
Because you got a wife now and you got a home, and it's very different.
Wife,
as you get older,
dog,
it's harder just to live on the road and be that guy.
It's gonna be real difficult when we have kids, and then I've got the kid at home. Like, I don't want to say this particular comedian's name, but a comic once told me that he cannot remember his daughters from ages 1 to about 8.
Mm.
And I'm like, that's horrific.
Yeah, that's tragic.
I don't want to be able to I don't want to look at my kid at age 12 and go, "Who are you?" Like, I don't want that to happen. So, I hope that I'll be able to parlay this into a TV show or a movie career or something like that. But still, constantly doing stand up. The one thing that I've noticed with a lot of comics is that when they get to the point where they have the TV show or the movies and they're not doing stand up as much, and then they just jump right back into it, it shows.
Hmm.
It shows you haven't done it.
They're rusty.
Like, like there's some comics that keep coming in and keep doing spots at the Comedy Store and stuff like that, and that's insanely valuable. It is a muscle. When I take 2 weeks off, that Thursday show coming back, rough.
Really?
Yeah,
that's interesting.
And you'd think like it's the same jokes, it's the same thing, but it's just the order, the pacing, the timing of it. It gets thrown off a little bit, I would always go and keep doing it. I've done a couple of movies, two of which are on Netflix. I did the Christopher Guest movie, Mascots.
Oh, right. Yeah, I saw you in that. That was very funny. The Worm.
Yeah, thank you. I got to be in a scene with Fred Willard. God bless him. And you know me. I'm like a high-energy guy.
Mm-hmm.
Fred, at age 80, whatever the hell, was so high-energy and we were improvising. It's Christopher Guest movie, so it's an improvised movie, and we're improvising the scene. Fred was so high energy, I had to be the straight man. I recognized that in the moment, was like, oh, I can't go over the top of that. So I played the straight guy, and I loved our scene. I think it came out really funny. But
also, you're in the presence of greatness.
Yeah.
So just sort of
let him drive.
Yeah, just out of just common sense, you would say, I'm going to do my best to set up one of the greatest improvisers in history
of all time.
I'll get mine further down the line someplace.
Yeah, it's like there's some people that. Like they want the ball and they want to take it away from LeBron, and it's like, he's the greatest player, so maybe just give him the ball.
It's a team sport.
Yeah.
Yes.
Or just let the guy fucking do it.
And improv is a team sport. It's, you know, a lot of people, the worst improvisers are the ones who get on stage and try to force in jokes or steamroll or try to get all the attention.
They have an impression where they're like, I have to do this impression in whatever scene.
It's a sure way to kill something like that. So the fact that you recognized your place and were able to benefit the good of the piece versus trying to just shine with smart.
Yeah, for me, trying to do a scene where you're where I would take the lead instead of Fred Willard is like the people that kill in God's name. Where they go, I'm going to kill you because you don't believe in my God. It's like, wait, do you believe your God is all powerful? Yeah. Well, I think he could handle it.
Let him take care of it. Mind your own business. Yeah, let it, stay in your lane.
Yeah, he could do it. He's fine.
That's funny and
so,
true.
Yeah. So, yeah. That so, I will continue to tour. I will continue to do the About Last Night podcast. I will be on the lookout for the Netflix special. Follow me on all the social medias, the Instagrams, the Twitters, all that, and come see me live. That's the time when you got to see it, because stand up comedy, while it's going through a boom with all the stuff on Netflix,
yeah,
there is still nothing like seeing a stand up comedy show live.
I agree.
To see a live show, it's the difference between seeing a band live and hearing the album. It's just.
They're both good.
Feeling.
It's just a different experience.
Yeah. Yeah, and being in a room with people that are all laughing on the same thing, all at the same page. I mean, I've come to see you guys do Babylon numerous times, and I love listening to the podcast, but there's still that extra energy when you go see a live show and you get to see your faces and Kevin's. Well, first of all, Kevin and his dance moves, you have to see that live just so you know what the hell he's doing.
Right,
you
right.
You just hear the audience laughing. And you're like, what's he? And it's probably something phallic that he's doing, but yes. At the same time, it's hilarious.
It's not highbrow stuff by any stretch of the imagination. And we just recently did a Ralph Report live for the first time, and it was me and Eddie Pence, who's the co-host on the show, and
Eddie
my
Pence.
Wife, and Steve Ashton, who's a guy from the UK who calls in and gives us material. It was all four of us on stage in front of a sold-out crowd at the Improv. And you're right. There's something about the community of laughing together that raises the energy of anything you're doing, unlike any other art form. I mean, you can listen to music by yourself. You can watch a drama by yourself. Yeah. But when you're laughing with a group of people, it's a whole different thing.
It's totally a community thing. And as the performer, I've noticed that, because we've done a couple live About Last Night podcasts, and when you see the audience, now there's pressure in your head. You're like, oh, wait, they haven't laughed in like a minute and 10 seconds. I've got to do something.
Right.
And then I had an acting coach that once told me, desperate people get super creative super fast. And I remember that, and it's absolutely true. The times when you come up with the greatest stuff is when you have nothing.
Yeah.
Because you're just grasping it. You're just throwing anything out there. That if you have your material, you're a slave to that and not trying anything new.
It's pressure that turns coal into diamonds.
That's right.
There you go, kids. That's your lesson for the day. Brad, I can't thank you enough for sitting down and doing this, man. It's been a long time coming,
and
the fans have just been aching for it, and I'm glad we could get together and have a conversation.
I am, and I'm gonna get a little sappy. I miss you, Ralph.
Oh, you're very kind.
I do. You were at the evil ship, and but even though you were there, you were a part of my mornings and a part of everything. And now, thank God, we have podcasts, and thank God we have the Ralph Report. I was worried that you were going to do something that wasn't the Ralph Report, so then I couldn't hear you every morning. Now I can, and I'm excited. And thank God for the Garmy, too.
Yes, God bless him. Thank you so much for being here, sir.
Anytime. Thanks.